Chapter 2. The Shadow. Captain Jethro Rogers stood erect, arms crossed, contemplating his recent activities on the moon. Failure to finally capture the small-time gangster, who once again slipped through his fingers, ignited a burning frustration within him. He was alone in the clear, oval-shaped lift, swiftly propelling him upward along the outer shell of the tall, mirrored building. A crescent moon was still visible in the warm glow of Earth's early dawn, smiling at him mockingly, like an invisible Cheshire cat. Like a forest of glass-covered monuments reaching to the sky, the city of Metropolis stood as a testament of man's crowning achievements in many things. The bustling activity below, in the city that never seemed to sleep, was transitioning between its nocturnal and morning shifts. The ground-level streets seemed to move as flowing rivers that washed through shadowy canyons between skyscrapers as a multitude of hover cars made their way to their destinations. Hundreds of feet above the city's floor, the freeway system snaked its way through man-made canyons like suspended spiderwebs of steel and concrete. The ranger withdrew the small piece of circuit panel he stripped loose from the debris of the killer robot that attacked him the night before and studied it again, slowly turning it over. He hoped someone at Ranger headquarters would be able to explain the mystery of where it could have come from. He glanced out the turbolift window, the sun highlighting his reflection in the glass. The public transit system was nearly at full capacity. Trains of cigar-shaped passenger cars, magnetically propelled along through reinforced plexiglass tubes, seemed to pulse in perfect unison, like giant artificial arteries, sending life to the buildings they penetrated. Hanging monorail trams slinked gracefully through the air, each egg-shaped cabin with its round porthole windows individually swinging out in succession as they swiftly rounded tight corners. The rest of the sky was filled with personal flying vehicles that seemed to swarm like gnats on a hot summer day. The turbo lift slowed to a stop as it approached the top floor of the 500-story Space Ranger headquarters building. As Jet stepped into the lobby, he was met with the metallic greeting of, "Good morning," in a voice mostly monotone, but still somewhat polite.
"If you say so, H-13, the ranger responded dryly as he walked past the short, squatty robot, busily polishing the floor. It was scooting back and forth on a round, rotating brush, spun by a motor that made up the bottom half of its orange body. A glint of light flashed on a small chrome emblem on its torso that read, "Hoover."
"Thank you,"
came the ill-fitting programmed response from the janitorial machine, dutifully going about its cleaning. Captain Rogers walked with a slight limp toward the door of the director's office.
"Good morning, Captain Rogers. Welcome back,"
said the eloquently spoken nickel-plated android secretary, sitting behind the desk.
"Go on in. They're waiting for you."
"Thank you, Maria."
Captain Rogers was not particularly looking forward to this meeting with the director and assistant director of the Space Ranger Corps. It was not often that he returned from an assignment empty-handed. This time, all he had to show for months of tracking Frankie Malone was a sprained ankle and a small piece of circuit panel in his pocket. The automatic door slid open in front of Jet, revealing a man standing with his back facing the exit, still speaking at the director. It was Rupert Praxton, chairman of the newly formed Oversight Committee of the Space Ranger Corps. He was a bureaucrat through and through, an expert at the conducting of public affairs for private advantage. For him, the appearance of procedure was more important than outcomes. His first priority was always himself. Naturally, Jet did not like the man.
"And remember, we have elections coming up soon. This type of reckless stuff has to stop,"
barked the chairman, wagging his finger at the director.
"I'm in charge of funding for this department, and that includes recommendations for its structure, if you know what I mean."
Rupert Praxton took a step to leave, then turned back abruptly and pointed.
"I mean it. This needs to be taken care of, and soon.
The bureaucrat spun to leave so fast that he almost ran into Jet, who was standing just behind him.
How do you do, sir?
Jet extended a hand.
I do what I have to,
replied the chairman, and shook the ranger's hand while walking out, not even looking at him. He didn't show his glowing smile today. He never did when the cameras weren't around.
Oh, good morning, sir. How do you do?
Said a tepid Brack Tellerson, trotting to the exit after Praxton. He quickly produced a hand, and Jet shook it too. The handshake was limp, cold, and clammy, like grabbing a dead fish. Tellerson was a rotund man, always hiking his pants up in the rear. He was once a governor, but now running for the Senate. He and Praxton were both cut from the same cloth. As soon as the two men left, Jet wiped his hand on his pants leg and crossed the spacious room toward the director's desk, which sat in front of a colossal wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling fish tank. The tank did double duty, also being the window that looked out over the city of Metropolis, giving the wonderful and surreal illusion of the aquatic creatures inside swimming through the air, along with the flying vehicles passing by outside. Sitting on the edge of the desk, one leg dangling, was the assistant director. He had an easy way about him, and always seemed to have a friendly smile on his face.
Hello, Jet.
Good morning, Assistant Director Hendricks, replied Captain Rogers. Jet's eyes centered on the hunched figure of a large man, arms crossed and elbows resting on the desk.
Good morning, Director Fredder, said Jet with a polite nod.
Jethro,
responded the grim-faced director in a deep, guttural voice and slight Hungarian accent. He was an intimidating-looking man. His eyes seemed to burn with a piercing intensity, suspended in a sea of sunken shadows created by the ridge of his brow. His hair had the appearance of white flame as its upward-twisting locks glowed from the iridescent light passing through it from the fish tank window behind. Sitting in a chair near the director's desk was an attractive young woman with short, light brown, wavy hair in space ranger attire. Before Jet reached the desk, the young woman stood and introduced herself. She stuck out her hand and, with a curt smile, said,
Betty Warren.
Jet Rogers, nice to meet you, he responded, shaking her hand.
It's nice to meet you, too. In the Academy, I included in my thesis your apprehension of the Jakari gang of Jupiter's Gamma 5 district. Well, actually, it was just a sidebar note.
She wrung her hands.
But anyway, I thought the way you tricked them into trapping themselves in that abandoned Eucidium mine was brilliant.
Well, I hope you didn't give me all the credit, said Jet with a nonchalant chuckle. It was kind of just an accident that it turned out that way. I don't know that I'd call their apprehension brilliant, but I appreciate the compliment just the same.
After giving her a quick smile, Jet turned to face the director when the assistant director started into him.
You sure made a mess of things this time, and an expensive one at that. For crying out loud, Jet, it's going to take at least a month for them to get that power plant repaired and operational again. This is very sloppy work for a ranger, even for you.
What? Now, hold on, I can explain, said Jet defensively.
And the cleanup that's involved. Good gravy, the whole facility in that section was completely destroyed. They're just starting the removal process up there now as we speak, continued Hendricks.
Does this have anything to do with those snakes that were just in here?
Jet jerked his thumb toward the door.
Don't worry about them, we'll take care of that, replied Hendricks.
I'm telling you, though, it's not my fault.
Jet was cut off again, this time by the deep voice of the director.
I also hear that you lost your gun again.
There's an explanation for that, too, if you'll just...
You checked out a new one this morning. Are you starting a collection?
The director seemed to stare straight through him. Jet paused for a moment, feeling deflated.
He was carrying a new gun, but the director knew that it was another replacement. He also knew it was futile to argue with the director. He reached into his pocket, pulled out the piece of circuit panel, and placed it on the desk.
"This is what caused the damage," said Jet pointedly. "It's from a robot that was equipped with rapid-fire laser cannons. They were hidden in a compartment in its chest."
He waited for Hendricks to pick it up.
"Do you recognize these markings? Over here, on the edge," he pointed.
Jet's two superiors became silent as they marveled at the circuit panel with its strange alien markings. As Jet stood in front of the desk watching them examine this new piece of evidence, his mind turned to Betty. Who was she, and why was she here? He thought this meeting was going to be just between the director, assistant director, and himself to discuss Frankie Malone's escape. He hated to make mistakes, and rarely did. But when things went wrong for Captain Jethro Rogers, they were usually big. He always dreaded the reprimand that was sure to follow. But today, to add insult to injury, there was this strange woman standing quietly by as his audience. A large helium-filled Zeppelin passed by, just outside the fish tank window. It was a tourism ship that gave sightseeing excursions of the city from above. The image of the magnificent, slow-moving vehicle crossing the window appeared like a giant whale attempting to feed on the smaller fish it pursued. With an ominous voice of ill boding, the director spoke.
"This is very interesting and rather disturbing, but you're going to have to let Frankie Malone go for a while. You're getting a new assignment, Jethro."
The assistant director handed Jet a folder marked Top Secret, Operation Dark Matter. Jet opened it and quickly shuffled through the papers until he came to some crime scene holographic photos that depicted three separate gruesome murders.
"How strange," said Jet. "Their clothing, they almost look like Ranger uniforms."
"Not almost," Hendricks replied grimly. "They are." Although it happened from time to time, it was rare to hear of a Ranger being killed in the line of duty, especially during this current time of relative peace in the solar system. But Jet had never heard of anything like this happening since the time his grandfather was in the Corps. That's what made the holographic photos seem almost unbelievable. With a troubled voice, Jet uttered,
"This really is a dark matter."
He turned to Hendricks.
"Who were they? And how did this happen?"
"Captains Mason and Conroy and Major Gordon," replied the assistant director. "We're not sure how this happened, or even why."
"What information do we have so far?" asked Jet.
Hendricks shook his head disparagingly.
"None. That's why you're being reassigned to this, Jet. All we know so far is that this must be the work of a single assassin."
He pointed to the holographs, indicating the obvious similarities in each victim's death.
"The one connection between the three Rangers is that each was investigating illegal weapons trafficking in the Martian sector."
Jet spread the holographic photos out on the director's desk and stood shaking his head, still in disbelief. Each Ranger had been gruesomely carved into many pieces, similar to a sausage link crudely run through a deli slicer. It wasn't uncommon to see images depicting heavy doses of gore come through the offices of the Ranger Corps. As a matter of fact, it was all too common. But when it concerned Rangers themselves, especially with this level of sadistic cruelty, that was something entirely different.
"These were all good men," Jet said. "Very experienced and extremely capable. Top of the line. No one would dispute that. A single assassin did this to some of the best Rangers in the Corps?"
"This is your new assignment, Jethro," said Director Fretter. "Take your new partner and bring in this assassin so we can find out who's behind this."
His hand was outstretched for Jet's. He took it, shook it hard, and let go. Strangely, Jet thought he detected a sort of farewell in it.
If you will all please excuse me, said the director, I have to leave for another meeting.
Out of the corner of his eye, Jet glanced at Betty. She returned a quick smile. He waited for the door to close behind the director, then launched at Hendrix.
Did I hear that correctly? He did say partner.
Jet jabbed his thumb in Betty's direction.
Her? If this is some kind of joke,
he pointed his finger at Hendrix.
I would think this is a highly inappropriate time.
The assistant director shrugged apologetically.
I'm sorry, Jet, but the director's made up his mind. There's nothing I can do.
Are you sure the chairman isn't pulling these strings? This sounds exactly like the type of idea that an inept bureaucrat would come up with.
You've always been allowed a certain latitude to speak freely because of your position, Jet, said Hendrix. But you're treading on thin ice in this current environment, so I'm going to advise you to be careful what you say.
These politicians, replied Jet, always talking about progress when they're constantly getting in the way. And another thing, he continued, whatever happened to the idea of one case, one ranger? If you don't think I'm doing my job well enough, you can always get someone else, sir.
It has nothing to do with that, Jet, I assure you, replied Hendrix. I know this is a bit unique, but this is how it's going to be. I would introduce the two of you, but it seems you've already met.
Forehead wrinkled and nostrils flared, Jet turned to Betty.
Just how much experience do you have, anyway?
Betty felt somewhat threatened and answered with a rather impish voice.
Just finished the academy.
Jet turned and glared at the assistant director.
You're not giving me a partner. You're making me a babysitter.
Hendrix glanced down to his shoe, raising his eyebrows in another apologetic gesture.
I told you, it's out of my hands.
Turning on his heel, with fists and teeth clenched, Jet marched straight for the door and grumbled to himself,
Great.
An uncomfortable silence between them. Jet and Betty stood, gazing out through the turbo lift glass as it descended to ground level. Each of them pondered their own questions of this unlikely pairing and intentionally avoided eye contact with the other.
What was the director thinking? Thought Jet.
It was unprecedented for a field ranger to have a partner, especially one so green. All she could possibly do was slow him down. The young female ranger nervously stole a glance at the man standing beside her. The man, she was told, would be her partner on her first assignment just earlier this morning. She was thrilled about the opportunity of working with such an accomplished ranger as Captain Rogers. Even though he was still relatively young himself, his achievements rivaled many of the most seasoned veterans. Her feelings of recent excitement were now replaced with doubt and uncertainty. His protest of her in the director's office made her feel like an unwelcome shadow. The turbo lift door opened. They walked through the main lobby and stood outside, atop the steps that, like a broadening waterfall, cascaded down to the street below.
If you don't mind my saying, Captain Rogers, even though you're not so keen on the idea, well, it's a privilege for me to get to work with you.
Betty flashed a weak smile, shuffling her feet. He glanced at her, reached into his pocket, broke off a small piece of jerky, grunted, and began chewing. She frowned. A sleek metallic silver hover car caught Jet's attention as it drove past. It had the new gull-winged top-opening doors and sporty split rear window. The driver looked strangely familiar.
What?
The ranger whispered unconsciously. It took a moment for him to realize that it was Frankie Malone.
It's him.
It's who?
Asked Betty.
What's he doing here?
What are you talking about?
Quick, get in the car.
Jet hobbled down the steps as best he could with his sprained ankle.
Which one?
Betty hurriedly followed Jet as he swiftly descended the steps, flapping his arms like an injured duck, trying to keep most of his weight on his good leg. Jet jumped into his car and fired up the engine. Betty blinked hard.
"What is that?"
she blurted. It looked like something she had only seen in a museum. This vehicle didn't hover. It sat, planted firmly to the street on what seemed like rubber tires. Its long, cigar-shaped body, positioned between four fenderless wheels, was coupled to the chassis with an intricate, crab-like suspension. It had a round, wood-handled steering wheel and pleated red leather seats that sat low in the open cockpit, two-thirds of the way toward the back. It was painted a deep chocolate brown, with six chrome pipes on each side, extruding horizontally from the engine compartment in the front and gathering in one larger pipe below that ran the distance of the chassis to the rear. Betty climbed into the passenger side.
"What are we doing?"
"Just hang on." With a push of the clutch and shifting of gears, they darted into the stream of traffic. By the sound of its fearsome rumble and cat-like quickness, despite its antique outward appearance, the car had some definite modern modifications. After navigating his way over to the far right lane, Jet turned to Betty.
"Do you see that silver car up there, just now turning?" She responded with a nod. "It's the thug Frankie Malone, a small-time gangster I've been tracking for over a month. He's either extremely bold or profoundly stupid showing his face so near Space Ranger headquarters. After all this time, I still don't know who he's working for. I'm gonna follow him and see where he goes. Maybe I'll finally be able to put this case to bed."
"I thought you were just taking off that case," said Betty.
"Yeah, you're right. But who am I to look a gift horse in the mouth?" he replied coolly.
She sat back, adjusting her posture against the supple leather seat, and surveyed the interior of this relic of an automobile from a bygone era. The gear shift was a slender chrome shaft, tipped with a round ivory knob. The instrument panel, set in an oval-shaped cove in the dash, was a cluster of round, chrome-trimmed, black-faced needle gauges. The ride was much smoother than she expected from a car that rolled along the pavement. The gradual up-and-down sensation of the suspension adjusting to the contour of the road, and the breeze spilling over the windshield, wisping the top of her hair, she found therapeutic and relaxing. She fixed her eyes on the silver car ahead and began to wonder just what this day had in store for her.
"I've been in pursuit of this guy for months," Jet began. "Frankie had started out as a typical thug errand boy for bosses of the local criminal element of this sector. Technically, he's small potatoes, as far as gangsters go. Hardly any real gang to call his own, and not too bright as a leader. But he's willing to get his hands dirty. This willingness to do anything allowed him to aggressively work his way up through the ranks, eventually rubbing elbows with bigger fish within the dark underbelly of the solar system's syndicate." Jet ran a red light to keep up, waved apologetically to the vehicle he cut off, then continued. "His connections alone could topple a great many dominoes within the organization." As far as Jet was concerned, Frankie was the key that would unlock many doors. This particular mobster was like a greasy pig, though, always finding a way to slip through the Ranger's fingers at the last moment. But this time, Jet thought, he was about to finally catch his prey. Parked at the edge of a shadowed alleyway, they sat and watched Frankie from across the street. He exited his car, looking around constantly, as he entered the old movie theater on the corner. It was an ancient building from a more romantic time that had been painstakingly restored to its original glory and was used to show films from early cinema. It was a beautiful structure, with its awning of 1,000 light bulbs protruding over the sidewalk, and its flashy vertical neon signage that read, "The Majestic." Currently showing was a French silent from early science fiction, "Le Voyage dans la Lune," read the marquee. A trip to the moon. How ironic, thought Captain Rogers. As soon as Frankie disappeared through the doors, Jet hastily said to Betty, "Let's go."
Entering the theater, their eyes adjusted to the dimly lit room as the light flickered from the projection on the screen ahead. They could see the silhouette of Frankie, seated up front, having a conversation with a creature that very obviously was not human. Jet motioned for Betty to take a seat. They sat together, a short distance from the aisle, in the darkness in the back of the auditorium, watching in silence the conversation between Frankie and the mysterious creature. Shortly, Betty leaned over and whispered,
"Who is he talking to?"
"That's what I'd like to find out," Jet replied dryly.
"Do you know what kind of species that is?"
she continued in a hushed whisper.
"One I've never seen before."
"What do you suppose he's doing here in Metropo—"
Before she could finish her sentence, Jet embraced her tightly and firmly planted a long, strong kiss on her lips. The offended young woman struggled unsuccessfully against this highly inappropriate pass. She failed to notice that the conversation up front had ended. Frankie Malone had risen from his chair and started up the aisle straight for them. The only thing Jet could think to do without blowing their cover was to turn his back to the aisle and make it appear as if he and Betty were just another couple sharing a romantic moment. Betty was finally able to break away. With a hard smack, she slapped Jet across his face, but not before Frankie had already left the room. Jet turned to the front. The mysterious creature was gone.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Fists clenched and eyes afire, she protested with a harsh and quite agitated voice.
"Come on, he's getting away."
The ranger swiftly moved toward the aisle, rubbing his cheek. Confused, still trying to assess exactly what just happened, she reluctantly followed. Frankie turned from the concession stand after purchasing a small box of cinnamon candy and saw the two rangers emerge from the dark auditorium. Like a cat realizing it had just jumped off the fence into the dog pound, Frankie bolted.
"He's seen us,"
Jet dashed, limping across the lobby and through the exit. The two rangers watched the silver hover car furiously dart into the street and begin weaving its path through traffic.
"He's not getting away again. Come on,"
Jet yelled, running for his car. With the roar of an angry lion, the engine of Captain Rogers' car came to life, simultaneously sending all four tires into a piercing cry of screaming rubber and smoke. Betty felt the seat push into her back, with an acceleration so strong it took a moment for her to catch her breath. The race was on. Zigzagging in and out of the moderately paced flow of traffic, the bellowing squall of the high-pitched revving engine echoed through the glass canyons of Metropolis, coming back to them like a chorus of raging demons, as Captain Rogers shifted through the gears. The knuckles on Betty's fingers were turning white as she tightly squeezed the hand grips beside the seat. They were traveling at dangerously excessive speeds she had never thought possible for a car. The left hand firmly gripping the wheel, his right aggressively massaging the shifter between each gear change, Jet, with a determined focus, never took his eyes off the goal far ahead. They passed through the traffic around them so rapidly that everyone else seemed to be moving in reverse. Gradually, they were gaining on the desperately driven fugitive. Frankie turned a hard left, cutting across two lanes of traffic, causing a pileup of five automobiles that had tried to avoid hitting him. He had entered an on-ramp that swooped upward to the suspended freeway system, hundreds of feet above the city floor. With a downshift and a quick acceleration through the turn, Captain Rogers continued the pursuit. As they rocketed upward, hugging the curve of the winding expressway, Betty's breath became choppy, and the palms of her hands began to sweat. The ranger's car, with its rubber tires, had a distinct advantage in the high-speed chase. Even though the rubber would sing with squeals of a slight skid, the ranger's car would dig in and slice through each curve with exact precision as they rounded each corner of the perilous slalom. Frankie, on the other hand, was throwing sparks left and right as he rode the guardrails through each curving bend in the road. Anti-gravity, responsible for keeping the hover car off the ground, allowed for much sway in the high-speed turns. Betty glanced at Jet, hoping to catch a look of composed confidence on his face,
reassuring her that they weren't going to die. Just then, she saw his look of grim determination relax, then contort into one of disbelief. She snapped her attention back to Frankie. At the bottom rear of the silvery hover car, two round apertures opened, revealing the orange glow of igniting rocket thrusters. With an exceptional boost of speed, the car catapulted forward, burst through the guardrail, and went over the edge. Jet stood on the brake, locking the tires and sending his car into a screeching skid right up to the edge where Frankie had gone over. Jet and Betty peered over the side to see what had become of Frankie.
He had landed in an open boxcar of bundled soft goods on a flying freight train, about 20 cars long, that was passing just underneath them.
"That man's crazy," said Betty breathlessly.
The last car of the train was just clearing the expressway as it slinked between the buildings hundreds of feet above the city's floor. Once again, Frankie was getting away. Jet glanced back over his shoulder. Another train, similar in length, was approaching, following the path of the first. With a rev of the engine and a squeal of the tires, the car took off in reverse some distance back down the expressway before they came to a stop. Jet had his neck cocked, looking back and down over the ledge, and appeared to be counting quietly to himself. Curious, Betty stretched her body and extended her neck to look over the side at what Jet was looking at. With disbelief and horror, she planted herself in the seat and grabbed Jet by his shoulder.
"You're not seriously thinking about—"
Tires screamed once more as they launched forward. Betty swallowed hard. She remembered the excitement she felt when she was first informed she was going to be Captain Rogers' partner. But she never dreamed the level of danger would be anything like this.
If she could go back in time to make that choice again, she would have taken it all back.
Betty's scream could be heard from a mile away as they flew off the side of the expressway.
"We're gonna die!"
There was an empty flatbed car that seemed such a tiny moving target. Everything seemed to move in a blurring flash and in slow motion, all at the same time. With a thud, followed by screeching rubber, Captain Rogers successfully landed the car. Their momentum would have carried them right over the side if the right front tire had not come to rest against the support rail at the front end of the platform. The left front wheel was precariously hanging off the edge. Jet peered over the side at the dangling tire, exhaled deeply, and wiped the sweat from his brow. He quickly changed his expression and turned to Betty with a slight, arrogant smirk.
"So, how do you like your first day on the job so far?"
She just glared at him with a disapproving scowl, unable to say a word. The morning had become early afternoon, and the sun was high in the brilliant blue sky. Pillowy patches of clouds appeared as a scattered forest canopy of white, strewn through trees of glass as the tall buildings grew upward through them. The chase was momentarily on autopilot as they waited for the trains to reach the warehouse district on the outskirts of the city. Frankie Malone would be surprised. He would not have expected the Ranger to attempt such a daring stunt on the freeway overpass. Jet kept his eyes on the train far ahead that was carrying his elusive fugitive. Betty sat quietly, looking down at the ground below that was now rising up to them as the trains began their descent. Large banners were being erected across the streets below for the annual Memorial Festival, which was still a few days off. As the first train pulled up alongside the loading dock, the supervisors of the worker robots stood dumbfounded as they watched the silver hover car come barreling down from atop the heap. The second train pulled in behind the first one. Frankie gazed in his rearview mirror in disbelief as he watched the Ranger's car drive off onto the loading dock. Through the warehouse and down a ramp, they emerged from a large hangar-type doorway in the rear of the building onto a ground-level alleyway. The chase resumed. Frankie Malone flew through intersections with reckless abandon, narrowly escaping several collisions. The Rangers followed, weaving their way through the sequential pileups that Frankie had left in his wake. Frankie barely squeezed through a busy intersection just after the signal turned red and the cross traffic began to go. Determined not to lose sight of the silver car ahead, Jet jammed his car down into a lower gear. The Ranger's car whined a high-pitched scream as he mashed the accelerator to the floor. Betty closed her eyes tight and gritted her teeth. Approaching the sharp dip in the road before the intersection, the car crouched, then sprang up as it hit the dip like a ramp, soaring through the air over the crossing traffic, barely clipping a plastic sign on a delivery truck's roof with its back tires. With a violent jolt, the car landed, and the pursuit continued. Frankie rounded a corner a little too wide and clipped the edge of a new radio transmission tower. A large metal sign dislodged from above and fell to the side of the road, just as Jet's car sped past. The sign read Gizmo Robotics, under construction. The traffic eventually became sparse as they raced down a major thoroughfare leading away from the city. As the curving road gradually opened up to a long straightaway ahead, Jet reached down and turned a nozzle on a cylinder under the seat. A small button atop the gear shift knob was engaged, sending the mixture of high-performance fluid from the cylinder to the engine. The tires squealed with renewed vigor, and the car shot off like a bullet. With the leather seat pressing more firmly into her back every moment, Betty stole a glance at the instrument panel. The speedometer, which read up to 170 miles per hour, was forcing the pegged needle hard against its limit. As Metropolis became a small speck on the horizon in the distant rear, trees and grass became more infrequent as the landscape transitioned from lush green to desert. They were now on the open road and swiftly gaining on the criminal. Jet yelled to Betty through the rushing wind of the open cockpit.
Use your laser pistol. See if you can hit his car.
I don't have one,
she yelled back, fighting to keep her hair out of her face.
What?
She stewed.
I just graduated from the academy, and I haven't been issued one yet. I was supposed to pick up my gun this morning after we left headquarters, but we started this crazy chase of yours first.
After a short pause, he gave a nod of concession.
Here, use mine.
He handed her his new pistol. Her first few shots went slightly astray as she adjusted herself to the wind and the movement of the car. Then she grazed his right fender. After one final adjustment, she sent a blast through Frankie's rear window, narrowly missing him. All Rangers are well-trained marksmen, and Betty was no exception.
Don't kill him, shouted Jet. I need to question him.
I was just getting his attention. That is what you wanted, isn't it?
Frankie cut a hard right, leaving a blinding trail of billowing dust as he barreled down an abandoned rural road. Bringing his car down to a safer speed, Captain Rogers stuck with him like a bloodhound, relentlessly refusing to be thrown from the trail.
I can't see.
Betty put her hand up to shield her eyes. Jet reached behind the seat and pulled out two pairs of goggles.
Put this on.
The pair he gave Betty was attached to a soft leather hood. The hover car now had the advantage. The road was extremely rough, violently jostling the two Rangers as they sped across the rugged terrain. Jet shouted over the noise.
Keep shooting at the car. See if you can disable it.
She hesitated.
I don't have it anymore.
Reluctantly, he responded.
What do you mean?
There was a long, uncomfortable pause.
Remember that giant pothole back there? It jarred me so hard I dropped it.
You lost my gun?
He glared at her. She pathetically forced an apologetic smile.
It was a really big pothole. I almost fell out.
He jerked his gaze back to the road.
You should have.
In the swirling haze of Frankie's trail, Captain Rogers began to notice boulders of increasing size and frequency zipping past them in a blur. Up ahead, in the dusty fog, he could see the orange glow of rocket thrusters beginning to ignite, just as they had on the expressway. but instead of increasing the throttle to try to keep up, his instincts told him to stand on the brake. The Ranger's car went into a sliding skid, not getting much traction at all in the loose dirt. Through the dissipating dust ahead, they saw Frankie's car shoot over the edge of the cliff. Captain Rogers' car was sliding too fast. They would not stop in time. Jet took his feet off the brake, and simultaneously popping the clutch, he threw the shifter into reverse and stood on the accelerator. Four rooster tails of dirt and gravel spewed forward, and the desperate roar of the mighty engine could be heard echoing from the abyss below as it furiously compelled the all-wheel drive to claw its way back to safety. The front of the car went over the edge and stopped, teetering, as the nose dipped downward. An echo could be heard off the far wall of the canyon.
"We're gonna die!"
The engine was still roaring, and the wheels were still spinning, vainly grasping at the air. The nose swung back up, and the rear finally settled, giving the back tires traction once more. With a few vicious jerks, the car wrenched itself back away from the edge. Jet and Betty both stood up in the car and leaned over the windshield to see what had become of Frankie. As the silver car grew smaller, plummeting to the dark abyss below, the gull-winged door opened. They saw a flash of orange with the hissing of jets. Frankie had a strap-on rocket pack, and with the swiftness of a missile, was streaking upward toward them. Quickly approaching the precipice just below the two Rangers, he swooped back out toward the center of the canyon, drawing a laser rifle.
"Get down!" Jet shouted.
In their haste to quickly take cover, they bumped heads. Frankie pelted the area with laser blasts as he made his escape in the opposite direction. When the blasting finally stopped, Jet peeked over the dash, rubbing his forehead. Frankie was flying away, far into the distance. He sighed.
"Oh, great."
Betty raised up, rubbing her forehead, and saw steam spewing from the car's radiator. The engine had been riddled with laser blasts. There was a long silence while Betty glanced back and forth between Jet and the spewing radiator. There was also a small trail of smoke rising from the communication radio under the dash. It had been fried from an electrical surge when the battery was hit.
"This is bad, right? What does this mean?"
she finally asked, almost afraid of the answer she knew was coming.
"This means we walk," said Jet, unable to hide the frustration in his voice.
He opened the trunk lid on the rear quarter panel of the car and pulled out a dark red poncho, which was basically just a small square blanket with a hole in the middle to pull over one's head.
"It's going to get cold tonight."
"Tonight? What do you mean tonight? It's still early in the day."
He looked straight at her and said gravely,
"Metropolis is about 30 miles that way. If we cut across the desert, don't take any breaks, and we're lucky. We just might make it back by tomorrow morning." Her eyes widened.
"Ah, great.